Welcome to Brothers King Media, where we view eternity through the lens of art. My name is Samuel.
And my name is Abigail.
And as you can hear today, we're actually shaking things up a bit. Solomon is, well, we're going to try something new. I mean, and Solomon's not participating in this one because he's not a big book reader, as you may have picked up from our previous podcasts. So we're actually going to be doing a new thing, reviewing books, which I've been wanting to do for a while. And since Abby has been a huge reader, we've been reading buddies most of our lives, we decided to jump in this and start reviewing books. Now, obviously, we're probably not going to do this as often as me and Solomon do this, due to the fact that reading a book takes a little bit longer than listening to a CD on YouTube. So, with that said, we're going to jump into a series and hopefully review every book in it. And I would like to eventually review the movies, including the BBC movies, which you probably didn't even know existed.
No. What are the BBC movies?
They're the England, or Britain, rather, has their own broadcasting station called BBC. They put out a lot of productions, such as Doctor Who.
Okay.
And they made a miniseries of Narnia back in the day, in the 80s.
So cool.
So we're going to do all the Narnia stuff.
Yeah, it's hard for me not to think of the movies when I'm reading the books.
I know, right? So we're going to be exploring the Chronicles of Narnia and all its aspects. And we're going to, for those that have been born in recent years, you may be familiar with what's called the chronological order of Narnia books, which starts with Magician's Nephew, ends with The Last Battle. We're actually going to go in the publication order, and there's a very good reason for this. For one, it's the order that the books were released in, and I've read the books both ways, and from what I've seen, they actually make more logical sense if you look at them as, here's a straight story. Here's a couple prequels / side stories. Okay, now let's tell the final story. So we're going to be doing it in publication order. And the first published Chronicles of Narnia book was The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. So Abby, tell me, what's your earliest memory of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe?
Oh goodness. My earliest memory. It's been a long time, I read those when I was a little kid. The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe was not the first book I read. I actually read it in quote-unquote chronological order.
Are you sure you listened?
Magician's Nephew.
Are you sure you read it? Because if I may intercept, I used to have the audio CDs. Focus on the Family had audio CD productions of them. And for my 15th birthday, I got The Magician's Nephew first, and we used to listen to it. So I'm just curious if maybe you're thinking of that, or if you just read it first.
I think I read it first,
okay.
Actually.
So you read The Magician's Nephew first?
I think so.
And did you read the books before or after you watched the movie?
Before. I read the books before I seen the movie. And then after... Then I read the books after I seen the movie, and then I couldn't help but pair the movie with the book because they did such a good job matching it, for the most part. As I read the book this last time around, I noticed there were some things that were not the same.
And we'll get into this more when we get to the movie, to reviewing the movie. I actually love the changes they've made in the movie, but the BBC productions are apparently much more faithful. They are, page for page, exactly the book.
I'd like to see that.
So it should be interesting. They're also, cheap budget. So we get to see Narnia on a budget.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah, and back in the 80s.
I know, right?
Wow. Okay.
So, but that's all in the future. For now, let's just talk about the book. This book is considered by many a literary classic. It's a fantasy classic. It's a children's novel classic. It's a Christian book classic. It really, as far as Christian literature goes, it's probably one of the biggest books ever. Just in popularity range.
Yeah.
And I would dare say C.S. Lewis was the first crossover artist in the Christian music, in, or Christian, not music, but Christian industry. Because his books were very big in both what we now call the secular market and the Christian market. But also consider this was produced in the 50s when such a thing as a Christian market didn't quite exist yet. So I find that kind of interesting. So tell me, what did you think of the book overall on your rereading here?
I loved it all over again and looked for all the small details due to this podcast. And I have to say that probably my favorite character is probably the White Witch and Lucy after she gets older.
Yeah. Now, I have to say, when I think of the White Witch, I think of the actress who plays her in the movie. And she does such a phenomenal job in the movie.
Yes, she does. And who I always associate, I know this sounds awful, but when I worked at a preschool, there was a lunch lady who looked exactly like the White Witch in the movie. And I told her, I said, have you ever seen this movie and this actress? And she's like, no. I'm like, not offensive because she's probably my favorite character, but you look just like her. So
that's funny.
It was funny. But that's the movie.
Well, I would dare argue that one of the reasons the White Witch is such an interesting character is she's the character that gets the most personality. And when I say that, I mean, really, the kids, like, they're given, like, you know, kind of surface personalities. Like, yeah, this is who they are. Well, I take it back. Edmund is given some surface personality. And Lucy.
Mm-hmm.
The two older ones are kind of just ignored most of the book, I feel like. And the witch is the one who actually, like, you know, gets to express what she's feeling or kind of go into a little bit of the Narnia lore from her perspective or, you know, get some witty one-liners.
Yeah.
She's the one who gets some actual characterization in this book.
Well, Aslan, too.
Yes, Aslan. And I take that back. He is really, even though the book's about the four kids, which, fun fact, the name Pevensey is never said in this book.
It's now said, that you say that, I recall that.
It's said in the next books, but everyone just knows it so well.
Yeah. It's not mentioned at all in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
Mm-hmm. So even though the Pevenseys are technically the main characters, Aslan steals the show in this book, I feel like, a lot.
Yeah, because he's the hero.
He is the hero. He's the one who saves the day, and he's a much better character. For those that can't see, she's shaking her head yes, because, you know.
Okay, yes, I agree.
So, let me back up a little bit and give you my earliest memories of the books. As I said, I was probably 14, and I was bought the audio productions that Focus on the Family produced. Focus on the Family is the guys who produced Adventures in Odyssey,
as
you know. And they produced these awesome audio versions of Narnia, which were like just kind of theater productions for radio.
I don't remember that.
They were super, super good. I loved them. And so I heard Magician's Nephew first. Then I heard this one. I just went in order. And then I only ever got up to The Horse's Boy on that version, because they went chronological. And then later, I went and found the books and read them all. And named my favorites, etc., etc. But I remember a particular Narnia impacted me a little bit as a teenager, because that's when I first started kind of branching out into different types of fiction. Because up to that point, I'd read mainly school books. I had read the Great Illustrated Classics version, so the abridged versions of classic novels, and basically anything I can get my hands on from the Christian bookstore. So a lot of Wally McDougall, Cul-de-sac Kids, all that stuff. And Narnia was like the first. It's funny looking back. When I looked at it, it was right when the movie was coming out. So the Christian bookstore, the stand they had, tried to make it look like this cool, edgy teen thing. Is what they was really aiming for. So I was totally intrigued. I'm like, ooh, this is really neat looking.
Yeah.
And then I read them, and they're good books, but they're still children's books. He wrote them. C.S. Lewis wrote these for 10-year-olds. Well, 12-year-olds, I'll give him a little bit of credit. But, I mean, the books do, technically speaking, kind of get slightly more violent as they go on.
Oh, definitely.
But they're still, at their heart, just good kids' books, which is why I find it so humorous. The store was trying to dress them up as, like, these edgy teen novels.
Yeah, just trying to appeal to
a different audience.
Yeah.
So, I actually read this one particularly, earlier this year. And I will start with my complaint.
You've not read it before earlier this year? Like, this year is the first time?
No, I read it again. I've read the Horned Owl series twice, maybe.
Okay.
And then I've read, like, The Horse and His Boy was my favorite audiobook. So I would listen to that one probably 20 times. So I'm more familiar with certain stories more so than others. This story I did have the audio version of. I listened to it a handful of times growing up. And then I read the books a few times.
I'm going to have to hunt down the audio version.
You can find them on YouTube, actually.
Oh, cool. Okay.
They're really cool. I like them a lot. So I read this book again earlier this year, not too many months ago. And my thought, this has always not been one of my favorites out of all the Narnia books. And I could never put my finger on it when I was growing up. I was like, why don't I like this? This one's the most classic. It's the big one that everyone remembers. And I finally decided the reason why this one never stood out to me is because the main characters, if you look at it as the main characters of the Pevensies, they don't do anything. Literally all they do is they stumble into the wardrobe. And then the plot just kind of happens to them. They're not
pro. They're following the plot. They're just going along with all the characters who are actually a part of the plot.
Yeah, they're not proactively doing anything. And I decided that's why the story probably doesn't stick with me as much, because I'm very much into literature. I'm very much into characters. And a good story should have your character proactively doing something to further the plot, rather than the plot just happening to them.
That's a good point. Think about that.
So that's why I say Edmund gets the most characterization out of all of the Pevensies, because he's probably the, other than Lucy deciding to go with Mr. Tumnus, which once again, Mr. Tumnus kind of just shows up and then the plot happens to her.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, spoilers, ahoy. Sorry I didn't say at the beginning. Spoilers ahoy. No restraints. For those that haven't read these books in 70 years, you know. But Edmund's the one character of the Pevensies who actually makes a proactive decision.
Yeah.
And that is to go find the witch and turn in his siblings.
Yep.
It's not a good decision, but he at least makes one.
He just wanted more Turkish delight, that's all.
Which I like, the book makes it much more clear than the movie. That it's enchanted Turkish delight.
Yes.
And I do like that concept a lot of, it wasn't necessarily that Edmund was just an evil person. Like, he was a bit of a brat, but he...
Yeah, but aren't most middle children?
Most middle children, and it's also kind of, I don't know how much C.S. Lewis put thought into it, because I think what he did is he had an idea for a story. He, at the outset, I've listened to a few different things talking about his, kind of his ideas for it. And when he was a kid, he had ideas for an imaginary world inside a wardrobe. So that's kind of the seed of that. And then he said later, after he converted to Christianity and was writing all this stuff, what if a Jesus-type figure existed in another world? What would that look like? So he kind of just built this world, which it's great world building, but then he's like, okay, I have a world now. I need some characters for this world to happen to.
Oh, okay.
And I forget where I was going with that. So, but...
The enchanted Turkish delight.
Yes. So I was going to say, Edmund, they kind of, I want to save some of this for the movie, but if you want to read between the lines, Edmund was coming off as an evacuee of World War II, which they don't say World War II in the book, mm-hmm. but it's obvious. It's the 50s. World War II is still fresh in everyone's minds. So he's coming off of World War II. He just had to leave his family. They're excited about being out in the countryside, but he's probably still kind of scared. You know, he had to leave his family. His dad's probably off fighting the war. And so that would, as a bratty middle child, that would cause you to act out a little bit. So that's why he's the most proactive character and actually has some characterization. I don't know. What do you think of the other characters? Like, do any of them stand out to you as anything?
Not really.
Well, let me ask you this. Is there, you said you really like the book. So I already said what I dislike about it, which I don't want to get the impression I hate it. I still think it's a good book. I think C.S. Lewis builds an incredible world. And if you look at it and pretend and just look at it as Aslan's the main character, it actually makes the book much better.
Yes, that is true.
If I never thought of doing that until you said that. So good suggestion. If I look at it as Aslan's the main character, much better story.
Because he's the hero and then
yes.
the witch is the bad guy with all of her little imps. And...
Yes. So what parts did you love about this book?
I love the whole like when the witch was in power, everything was winter, but when her power starts to lessen, it starts turning into spring, and all the little things around it
mm-hmm.
that just happen. The one thing, if I'm going to name a dislike, I'm going to say it's the Santa Claus.
I love Father Christmas. He's so much fun.
I mean, cool, but like, I was never the kid who believed in Santa Claus. Sure, he was there, but I wasn't super excited that, hey, we're going to put milk and cookies out for Santa Claus. And by 10 and 12 years old, I don't believe in Santa Claus anymore.
Well, that's why I like it, though, because the idea I think he was going for, this magical world where all the stuff that we take as myth in this world exists in this world.
And that might be true because, like, the characters, even on the bad guy and good guy side, like the creatures in the armies, there's, like, the half-horse, half-man.
Centaurs.
There's they're not seraphims. What are they? The birds that
that
have a tail.
And griffins.
Yes, griffins exist, and and this creepy thing.
Minotaurs. Is that what you think? The buffalo guys?
No, the hooded.
Oh, and they're hags. Is what they're called in the book. Hags.
Yeah.
And I like that he even goes even further, and so it was actually a big complaint against him because you know that C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien's were buddies, right?
I did not know they were buddies, but I can see that being the nature of the books.
So J.R.R. Tolkien's wrote Lord of the Rings, The Hobbit.
Mm-hmm.
They were actually part of a group with a third guy named the Inkwells.
Oh, wait, I think I remember that.
Yeah, I would hope so. It's a very big part of literary history. They were the Inkwells. They would meet every week in a bar because in Europe, you drink beer with everything. It's just kind of what you did, especially back in the 50s. So they would meet...
Drink away the war.
Or maybe it was tea. I can't remember which. One of the two. But they would meet every week, and they would just basically compare their stories. They'd be like, here's my story, and compare with each other.
It'd be interesting. I've never read any of J.R.R. Tolkien's work, but maybe to see, like, what ideas did they feed off each other?
Oh, yeah. So... Tolkien was actually really, he disliked C.S. Lewis's Narnia because he thought it was too derivative. He didn't like how C.S. Lewis was like, yeah, I'm just going to pull from Roman, from Greek mythology, and I'm going to pull from British mythology, and mix it all together. He didn't like that. He thought that was really stupid and derivative. And C.S. was like, it's for kids, who cares? So... I do like how he even has, like, you know, dwarfs. He has the tree spirits and the water gods. Because, like, they're within this world's context, they're gods with lowercase g. Aslan is the, you know, the creator of Narnia, the god. But they're just, like, what we would called gods from mythology, and they're totally under Aslan because it's its own world, its own system.
Yeah.
And I find that kind of a cool concept. Now, granted, when I read it was one of those things, when I read it as a kid, I was like, oh, I hope mom and dad doesn't read the line about the god. They'll never let me read this again. But as I get older,
refresh my memory about that.
So it's just basically all that he mentions is the nymphs in the wells and the stream are the daughters of the water god.
Not in the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
No, he mentions that in later books.
Okay, yeah.
But once again, it's all really great world building, and he makes it very clear these aren't like the pagan gods we know of. Rather, they're just characters that are named after our pagan myths and stuff, which I find very cool.
So then, in reality, the fact that he was pulling from different worlds really fit Santa Claus in there as well. I'll admit he fits, even though I don't like Santa Claus as much. But
I get you. Or Father Christmas, as he's known in Britain.
That was one... Another part that was different from the movie.
Mm-hmm.
The movie is like they were running on the run and then they hid under the bridge and thought it was the witch. Whereas in the book, it's they left before the witch did. They walked all night long and then they crawled into this hole and slept all night. And then they came out and thought it was the witch. So... And it for the purpose of the movie being shorter and just getting to the end, they changed it up a little bit. But in that instance, I like the book better.
Yeah, and we'll get to the movie, the differences and everything later. But I see what you're saying. Once again, though, that kind of goes to illustrate the point of the plot just happens to the Pevensies. They go to sleep, and then Father Christmas just shows up.
Yeah, they didn't ask for Father Christmas to be there. They weren't seeking Father Christmas. They weren't trying to make the... Which is power weaker or anything. They were just trying to get to Aslan.
Yeah.
Because the beavers told them to.
Which, also, the beavers are fun characters in there. They're really snarky.
Yeah.
So I like the beavers a lot. They're a lot of fun.
In the book, she wanted to take her sewing machine on this. She's like, will the sewing machine come with us? Can we carry the sewing machine? And
I think he was kind of making fun of little old ladies who, like... just want to pack up everything to go on a trip to wherever. Or moms in general. So I like that little bit of humor. And that's one thing I feel like is missed out about C.S. Lewis. Everyone looks at him as a solemn fantasy writer. And everyone forgets he actually had a really funny sense of humor. I'll point it out a few times throughout the coming books. But he liked just making stuff that was just funny. That had no purpose other than just being funny. And I always find that kind of intriguing part of C.S. Lewis's books that everyone forgets about a lot of times. So that's kind of the story, if you will. Now let's kind of jump into, because it fits into the next part of the book, the theological content, if you will. Or theological content is in there.
But the
ideas in the book. One thing I heard when I first heard about Narnia, I had a friend here at church recommend the 1970s cartoon, which I don't know if we're going to watch because then it'll be like we're watching four different versions of the same story. But the 1970s version of the cartoon of just Lion, Witch, and Wardrobe, and she really loved it. I was like, oh yeah, it's really cool. It's like winter's there, like sin. And then, Aslan, the Jesus character, comes and he melts away the sin from their lives and brings spring and redemption to them.
I would have to say sort of, but then that's a little bit off because had the children not entered the wardrobe, there would have been no reason for Aslan to be there because the curse or sin couldn't have been broken without the kids. But then maybe that's like the willingness of humanity to come to Christ.
Maybe. I've also heard it said that the Turkish delight represents sin as well. Which I feel like that metaphor is a bit more clear cut.
Yeah, like, indulging, and it always makes you want, like...
Want more, and it's all-consuming.
Yeah.
So I like that idea a lot. The very obvious metaphor of Edmund going the Judas route and betraying them all. And then, right, since he's doing, you know, this is what Jesus would look like in a different world. In this telling, Judas gets redeemed. And I like...
Well, maybe you could... Maybe you'd be Peter instead, because he is redeemed.
Yeah. I mean, it depends how close you want to run parallel.
The sinner who's redeemed.
Yes, by the death. You know, Aslan dies for him and then rises from the dead and comes back to kill the wicked one. So the metaphor is very obvious for anyone who's raised in any kind of biblical home. It's right there, which is probably why this book particularly, since it has that very strong, very obvious metaphor, is probably why it's been so popular for so long, in the Christian audience at least.
True.
Because everyone can obviously see that, oh, he died, rose again. And I do like the added bit of he died just for one person, much like, you know, Jesus died for each individual person as well as all of humanity. It was a very personal act. And I feel like people get so busy talking about how, you know, Jesus died for all of humanity, all of mankind's sins, they forget to talk about how much of a personal act it really was.
I think there's this quote by C.S. Lewis. I can't guarantee that it's C.S. Lewis, but it's along, and I don't have the quote like 100% correct, but it's along the lines of, if you had been the only man, he still would have died for you, or like something along those lines. I have it written somewhere. I'd have to look it up. But
that's a cool quote. So that's any other like ideas or concepts that stand out to you?
What about the wolves? What do you think about the wolves and the Morgrim and the police? Just random.
So I think
Morgrim's quite a character. Like
he is creepy. And he is the one that Peter kills, isn't he? Or is it just a random wolf?
I actually think, Morgrim is the one that Peter killed.
Okay.
Because the other wolf who was with Morgrim goes back and says that Morgrim was killed. So.
And I will just, I know I'm beating this horse to death, but I just want to point out, even when Peter went to defend his sisters, he went because Aslan said, go defend your sisters.
Yeah, he said, that's Susan's horn.
And Aslan's like, go, shoo. So even then, the plot just kind of happened to him. But
he had to be told what to do.
Yes. I'm sorry. I promise I'm done beating that dead horse.
But it's a valid point. I've never actually thought of it that way.
And I feel like... it's something that gets better as the books go along. I will point out my favorite books, and in my favorite books of the Narnia series, the kids are actually doing stuff, and I appreciate that. But I actually heard today, I was reading about it or something, or no, I was listening to a thing, and they said, it could be almost a parallel drawn to the Cold War. Of, this dictator has taken over, and they have the secret police, the wolves, watching everything.
Yeah.
And even some of the trees on her side.
Yeah.
And, she has a propaganda, because one of Mr. Tumnus's books is Man a Myth.
Yes.
So that could be seen as a propaganda book from her, because she doesn't want this prophecy to come true, so.
Yeah.
So she would be like, nope, no humans. They're fake. So I like the wolves. They're pretty cool. I feel like, once again, I don't want to talk about the movie too much, but something that's done better in the movie. But they're really cool for what we get in this book. We get like 5 pages total with the wolves, I think. And I do like the scene where he jump scares Edmund.
Yeah, and that is in the book.
Yes, and that's why I'm saying I like that scene in the book. Because it makes Morgrem out to be very creepy. Like, or else, not so favorite.
Yeah.
And I do like that a lot. Other than that, though, he doesn't do too much other than just spy. And just be generally creepy. And, yeah, that's, it's, I guess, I don't know, is there too much more to say about it? It's a short book. It is a kid's book.
It is a short book.
So
it took me maybe 2 hours to read.
Yeah, it's not meant to be a long epic or anything. The only other, like, ideas that are non-Christian ideas in it would be, I would say, embracing childhood. How, this is something I actually listened to a college lecture on children's literature. And I didn't get all the way through because the CDs I had started scratching. But basically the idea was that children's literature didn't start becoming about how good childhood was until like the late 1700s, 1800s. Prior to then, childhood was looked at something as you need to grow out of this. Stop being a child.
Yeah, push to grow up as soon as possible.
Yes.
So that you can work or like.
But then eventually children's literature shifted and became, childhood is something to be treasured. This innocence will never get back again. And I feel like that's definitely an idea he pushes for in this book in particular. Because we haven't talked.
Especially with the time variance between the two worlds.
Yeah.
And like even in the very end of the book where they're searching for the white stag and then happen to go through the wardrobe and they're children again rather than grown up.
And I feel like one character we haven't talked about too much because the characters aren't too much to talk about, but Lucy, she is the embodiment of idyllic childhood. This is what a perfectly innocent, good child looks like.
Yeah, especially like when the professor, when Peter and Susan think Lucy's lying.
Yeah.
They go to the professor and the professor's like, well, has she ever given you a reason to think she lied?
Mm-hmm.
Well, how about you actually believe her?
And I like that even the professor, he's almost childlike in his ideology because that's not a grown-up thing to say. Grown-ups would be like, oh, yeah, she needs to stop lying. It would take a child to think, you know, well, if she's not lying, then she must be telling the truth. And I like his logic. Do they ever use logic? Do they teach logic anymore?
Yeah.
Because the three options are she's either crazy, she's lying, or she's telling the truth.
Yeah.
And I like that a lot.
And the fact that telling the truth would be the logic, you know.
The logical answer.
Yeah.
I like the professor a lot. He's a fun character for all two pages he's in.
Well, I think also I like the professor a little more even after watching the movies because the movies give him more character.
Oh, yeah. The movies give everyone more character. And that's what I'm going to get into when we talk about that. I guess this one is a little bit hard to talk about apart from the movie because we watched that movie so many times growing up.
True. That is true.
We owned it on DVD and probably watched it once a month or so.
I'll still, to this day, sit down and watch it if given the opportunity.
Like, we'll rewatch it eventually for the sake of this podcast.
Yeah.
So. But
it's the out of the movies, that one is my favorite so far.
Oh, yeah. It's the best produced. But once again, we got to try not to talk about it too much. So that's the other idea is the innocent childhood. So that's kind of the ideas in the book. I feel like the ideas he likes, he makes very blatantly obvious, and there's not too many. So I would almost say the ideological content, it's good, but it's not overly deep. It's just like, yeah. It's an inch deep and a foot wide, but what it produces is really, really good. I like it a lot. So anything else that stands out to you in the books?
Probably the only other thing that I couldn't help but notice, but the wardrobe, the first time Lucy goes in, C.S. Lewis is telling this story, and he's like, it would be very foolish if she were to shut the door behind her. And then when she goes in again, he says it again.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't shut it because it would obviously be foolish. Edmund goes in. Edmund shuts the door, and the professor's like, and he did that because he was foolish, essentially. Or, like, Edmund didn't know foolish people.
Don't shut the door.
Exactly. And he was just really repetitive about the door.
Yeah, I like two things about this. One, it kind of goes back to C.S. Lewis's sense of humor that a lot of people forget he has or had. The second thing I like about it is he almost pulled a Lemony Snicket before Lemony Snicket was a thing, and the fact that he's like almost a character in his own book. He's not, but he like refers to himself, you know?
Exactly. That's how you knew he was telling the story.
Yeah, like I like the idea that he's just recounting this story. Like, he's almost a character in the book, but he's not. He's just C.S. Lewis telling us the story. And I find that kind of an interesting thing to be done.
It very much makes it like a almost a quote-unquote bedtime story type, like, telling.
I never thought of that. But being a kid story, I could hear it like as a bedtime story there. So I do like that. So that's really all I can think of on the book. One thing, maybe I should say this for the movie, but there's some things that the kids do that would never happen in modern day kid stories. For one, they just go exploring through the house. Modern kids would never just go explore a house.
That's also due to the amount of technology that we have today.
Yes.
iPhones and Instagram and Facebook and pictures. And if you think about it, the 50s, the most they probably had was books and
They had
checkers.
A wireless, which was a radio. It was what they called the radio back then, a wireless.
Yeah. But
yeah, not as much as you. I can see that. And then the other thing that this cracks me up every time I read it or I see it, Lucy stumbles into the wardrobe, and you know, she feels the crunching on her feet, whatever, gets back there, and Mr. Tumnus shows up. And my first thought is, stranger danger, run, kid, run! Stranger danger! And because it's the innocent 50s, she's just like, oh, it's a half-naked man with goat legs. Yes, I'll come and have tea with you.
That's a good point to point out.
Like, no kid nowadays would ever.
Okay, answer me this. Why is it that the one time she was expecting to find Narnia, did she find the back of the wardrobe?
Because the professor explains it later that for whatever reason, and I mainly say plot convenience, but you can never find Narnia when you're looking for it. Which kind of goes back to, I feel like, the Narnia, the world, because really Narnia is the country, technically. There are other countries in this world. But this universe is almost like its own character. It goes back to what I said earlier. C.S. Lewis built this really cool world. And for the sake of the plot, you're not going to get into this world unless it wants you in there. You could argue unless Aslan wants you in there for some reason, which I don't know if maybe, you know, if they went in ahead of time, they would have found Mr. Tumnus, and then, I don't know, I guess Edmund wouldn't have met up with the White Witch. Stuff couldn't have happened the way it happened in the book if they would have just went in the second time and found it with no problem, right?
True.
So it's more plot convenience than anything. But that brings up my second thing. In the book version, they first get back into Narnia, and Peter makes a big deal. It's like one of the few independent thoughts he has, where he's like, well, we got to go save this chap, Mr. Tumnus. He did a lot for my sister. can't we go do a search brigade or something, or dress up as a, what does he say? Dress up as money painters. Like he's pulling all these ideas from like Hardy Boy books or something. I don't know. To go save this chap. And once again, it's something kids nowadays, that's a sensibility that's kind of been lost. Most kids, especially if you're the oldest brother in charge of your family, would just be like, we don't know this guy. Forget it. We know nothing about him.
Yeah, very much a save your own skin rather than help your neighbor.
Yeah, we're just gonna get out of here. Which honestly sounds like a more realistic motive.
And that was also actually Edmund's thinking. He's like, we don't know him. It could be a trap.
Yeah.
But Edmund's motive was he was just had a rotten attitude because Lucy was right. And he was a butthead about it.
But, you know, some people nowadays would say he was the sensible one. He was the one that was actually using some logic behind it. There's a phenomenon within the tropes of writing books called a Draco in leather pants. And it's a term pulled from Harry Potter books. But the basic premise is you take a character who's really rotten and kind of bad, and you make all these excuses for why they must be bad and why they're actually not as bad as we make them out to be.
Yeah.
And Edmund gets that treatment on some internet forums, and I find stuff like, they're like, yeah, he went out and he was willing to apologize to Lucy initially before he met the witch. And he was the one who actually had the sense to try and just get back home rather than, you know, try and find the stranger they don't know, and et cetera, et cetera. I don't agree with it, obviously, but I just find it interesting that some people would go that far with it.
Yeah.
So that's the book. Once again, not a very long book, though we have managed to talk about it for a minute. So we're going to go ahead. Obviously, me and Solomon usually give our rating of 9 stars. It's kind of hard to do what is the lyrics and the music sound like. So we're going to shake it up a little bit. 3 potential points for the thematic contents, ideas, motifs, anything throughout the book. 3 points for how well the story goes itself, and 3 points for how well it holds up as a work. So I'll kick this off. As a story itself, once again, if I shift gears and look at Aslan as the main character, I can give this 2 points on that. I originally was going to give it lower, but when I look at it as the Pevensies aren't the main characters, it actually makes for a better story. Because then we actually didn't talk too much about Aslan, I guess. Because I guess I was complaining too much. I don't know. But he was the... he is the main character that you never get to see to the end, which I kind of like about him. He's the main character from the shadows. And then when he does show up, he shows up in a big, very big way. He's like, I'm here, you know, this is me. And,
Start singing that song from the Grinch. This is me.
Yeah. And beyond that, he also, one of my favorite.
He's a very strong character.
Yes, very strong character. And my favorite interactions with him is right after he resurrects and the girls are playing with him. And I like the idea of, once again, this kind of reflects some of C.S. Lewis's ideas about Jesus, which, you know, I can't say theologically I agree with all his stuff, but he had some cool ideas. And one of the ideas he reflects here is that God is both simultaneously a God of wrath and simultaneously a very loving and playful person. Because he created all this stuff, everything he created is from his personality. So I feel like that's very well represented in the scene where right after he resurrects, the first thing he does is plays tag with the girls.
Yeah.
And then...
That's a good thought.
And then he turns around and says, okay, playtime is over, we had our fun. And then he like goes all into... I'm going to go eat someone now mode and says, get on my back. Let's go.
Yeah. And gets his army together.
Yeah. And takes charge.
To go defeat the witch.
So I like that characterization of him a lot.
Yeah.
So when I look at him as the main character, 2 points on story. As for thematic elements, like I said, they're only an inch deep and an inch wide, but what's there is good, if not a bit oversimplified, which for a kid's book, I guess it should be oversimplified.
Exactly.
So,
even for some adults, you know.
Yeah. So I'm only going to give its thematic elements a 1. There's nothing too horribly deep here. I feel like he actually hits on some better thematic elements in future books. And then as for how well the story holds up, I'm tempted to give it a full 3 because it's obviously held up very well.
I'd give it a full 3 because I really like the book. It's actually probably one of my favorites.
But for me personally, it's not the weakest book of the Chronicles of Narnia, but in my opinion, it's on the weaker side. So I'd only give it a 1 there. So out of 9 potential points, I'm giving this a very measly 4. And I didn't intend to go that low, but it just kind of happened. So I'm giving this a 4 out of potentially 9. So what are your thoughts on this? I mean, what me and Solomon always do is we both give our rating and then we meet in the middle. So don't go purposely high just to even me out. But
I would probably give it like a 5 overall.
Well, break it down. Why? So let's start with the story itself. What do you give that out of potential 3?
Maybe a 2.
Okay.
Like the story, just because it flowed really well. I mean, while the plot happened to the characters, and the main character just shows up later, it still flowed really well from one thing to the next. Everything connected.
Yes, it wasn't just like this happened? Okay. It was very logical in its progression. Yeah. I get where you're going. And once again, great world building.
Yeah.
He built a very good world.
I mean, who doesn't like to travel into another world? That's one of the whole purpose of reading a book, to get out of your own world that you're in at the moment.
And but like you believe Narnia exists within the context. Like it makes sense that this world exists. It's not so flabby that you just can't see right through.
And it has like elements that we have in our own world. It has snow. It has water. It has
stuff we can relate to.
Yeah, and even like the mythological characters. Like, well, yeah, we know they're not real, but we've interacted with those characters before because they were pulled from our world. Like they were pulled from our history books. They were pulled from our mythological books. Like, so they're not foreign. Like, so this is a work, like we were saying earlier, a combination of world elements.
And you're saying in this case, which not like hardcore fantasy lovers would disagree, but you're saying this is a good thing in this context.
Yeah.
I can agree with that. Okay, so 2 points for the story itself. What about ideologically,
I'd have to agree with you on the 1 because it's not super deep. It's not like, let me sit here and think a moment about how deep this is. It's very simple and like.
But it's not bad. It's just simple.
No, it's not bad. It's just simple, which is good sometimes.
Yeah.
So, overall 5.
And then how well it holds up a 3? Do you still hold to that?
Yeah.
And why do you think it holds up so well?
Probably out of biasness because it's one of my favorites. It was my first book that I interacted with in Narnia. So it's always going to be like tops. Because like when I think, maybe not tops, but one of the favorites because one of the characters, like, the White Witch is like...
rooting for the bad guy.
Unfortunately, I am rooting for the bad guy, but, like, she's just such an awesome character, but she's not found throughout all the books.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, I mean, I'm kind of sad that the book, the characters are not... I mean, they are somewhat consistent, but they're definitely not the main characters throughout the whole entire series.
Yeah. And I like the way he does that, but I'll explain it more when we get in the next book.
Yeah.
So that actually gives your rating a 6 out of 9, which if we meet in the happy medium, that's a 5. So a solid 5 for our first book here. And that is our feelings on The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Any other last thoughts?
I think we've summed it up pretty well, actually.
So, as always, feel free to email us, look us up on social media. Do you want people to harass you on social media, or would you rather just they can go to our normal Brothers King Media links?
It don't matter, honestly.
So, I will go ahead and put all those links in there. And once again, my name is Samuel.
And I'm Abigail.
And keep being that glimpse of eternity. Rock on.